Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Our thanks, of course, to Ollie Slack for the football show. I am Matt Bentman and I am here live in the studio with Alan Alder and Sue Bailey. And now a quick rundown of the culinary features that we have for you today.
Food blogger and writer Laura Donoghue brings us the last in this series of food essays.
I'll be visiting all my favourite local haunts this year for all manner of other vegetables, salad crops and herbs grown right here.
And the foraging chef is back with some tasty ideas for free eating.
I'm just going to the back garden instead of going out and buying loads of spinach or something. We just go out back and pick some chickweed for dinner.
We are positively fizzing over with beer and wine chat from Bacchanalia on Mill Road.
He was a chatty bloke.
Oh, he's a kind of a friend and a customer, so yeah. I've known him as long as I worked here, so yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
And we learn about bees.
I try to place my apiaries, my beehives, without chemicals access, close to nature reserved or organic farms.
And we are here live in Gwydir Street studio today, Saturday. You can contact us by text on 07919 070 490. Or you can email flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can send us a tweet to @flavour105.
Even though it was frosty this morning, you can still go foraging. Here's the foraging chef, Steve Thompson, talking about foraging alliums. But what are alliums? Here's Steve to tell all.
The first and most obvious one is wild garlic. It's what so many people pick forage. Everyone loves it. Everyone thinks it's a springtime plant. It is, and that's when it's fully out. It's when you can get the flowers. Late spring, early summer is where you get the seeds. But we're going to talk about the shoots that first come through, and that's what makes it a winter spring plant. So certain parts of Cambridgeshire, you'll find the shoots starting to come through. They're a lot milder in taste than the full leaf comes through. You've still got the lovely garlicky, fresh, sweet taste to it. Not quite as garlicky, basically. It's shooting through. Parts of Cambridgeshire you will find it, but you want to look for the less clay heavy soil. So Cambridgeshire is quite a lot later in a lot of things and other parts of the country, purely because how thick and clay the soil is in lots of areas. You've got some other areas of chalk and things like that. Things come through a lot quicker in chalk. I've not found wild garlic in that, obviously, though, but you're looking by riverbanks and everything like that. I'm sure people have their own patches of it already, but go have a check of it now. We've had a very mild winter. Things will be starting to come out early. Certainly walking down the paths in the village, I've been noticing some arum or lords or ladies. That's really the only thing that you could confuse wild garlic with.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is there anything you could risk?
Arum is poisonous, but it doesn't smell garlicky. And it does look quite different. So a little bit of attention to detail, and just, does it smell like garlic?
Right, so basically go touch it, rub your fingers together, smell, use your nose.
Yeah, there's similar sort of things to it. It is literally, with the alliums, does it smell of garlic? And it's quite an easy one. The other ones we're going to talk about at the moment are three-cornered leeks, which are an invasive species over from the Mediterranean. So feel free to pick as many of those as you want. They're not one that's supposed to be here. So we pick, we go wild.
What do they look like?
The easiest way, I mean, they're called three-cornered leeks for a reason. So if you look at the leaf, it's in a V shape. It's almost like a blade of grass.
Does it look a bit like a leek?
It does. The bottom of the plant looks a bit like a leek, but it's smaller. It's a lot smaller. So think half the thickness of a baby leek. So a lot thinner. And the bottom of the plant looks like that. And then it comes out and the leaves start to come up. And they're three-pronged, hence a three-corner. So you think in a V, you've got the top on either side, and then the third prong is the bottom of the V. And again, when they start to flower, they're easier to identify from the next one, which we're going to talk about, which is fewer flowered leeks, or fewer flowered garlic is his other name. Both absolutely very similar to wheat, basically. Quite similar in looking. The differences in the flowers are you've got a yellow line going through the petals on the three-cornered leeks, whereas on the fewer flowered, the petals are completely white. Both absolutely lovely, really nice. Again, anything else you could really confuse those two with? Maybe young snowdrops, young dandelions. Nothing that's going to smell of garlic again.
And so, these have a strong...
Yeah, both of these are very much garlicky leeks. So the edible alliums that we go for. So think your chives and things like that. Chives, leeks, onions, wild garlic. It's all of these have a very strong oniony, garlicky, leeky smell to them. The fourth one we're going to talk about as well is crow's garlic, which is just starting to come up around the corner from my house. So I'm just waiting for it to get up big and then we're going to go grab some. And that looks more like chives. You're looking at wild chives, basically. They're hollow like chives. They're a little bit more V-shaped on one side. So as a chive is completely round on the tube if you had to cut it in half, the crow's garlic is kind of round with a little indented V on one side. And they have the leaves that go off them as well a little bit, rather than being a single strand like a chive, but they are gorgeous as well. All much of a muchness in flavour, just different intensities of garlic and onion, basically, between the lot of them.
When it comes to flowering, I found that you could eat chive flowers, which I didn't know. But what about the crow's garlic?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, the flowers are all edible on that, as well as they are with the three-cornered leeks and the fewer flowered leeks.
But they're not going to be flowering yet, are they?
No, we're far too early for that at the moment. You want some more warmth. So when the spring starts to get warmer, then you'll start seeing the flowers come out. After the snowdrops have been and gone, basically, then start looking out for the other allium flowers. And they're very similar to chives. You've got a lovely purple flower on top as well, very similar to a chive flower.
Why do we get all these sort of wild alliums? What's their history? Why so many of them?
With the three-cornered garlic, that was another one that was brought over from the Mediterranean. So I'm not sure if that was Roman times or not, but a lot of the plants are invasive. But yeah, because they're invasive, they're not meant here. You can pick as much as you want.
So you don't have to worry about you're going to get done for picking something.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild garlic, though, is not invasive. That is meant here. It does spread, but pick it responsibly. Yeah, it's been getting a lot more popular the last couple of years. And certainly last year, the patches that I go to now, which are more on the edge of road size and things like that, they've really been decimated. And it's just polite to leave it how you saw it, basically. So don't go there and trash the place. Don't go there and take a massive big square out the middle and tramp everything down and leave your litter lying around. Leave it as if you've not been there. It leaves it pretty for everyone else. Cut it off at the bottom. Don't pluck the bulbs out, because it regrows through bulb splitting more than the seeds, wild garlic. So the bulbs will split off and then you get another plant. It keeps it going year after year after year. I'm not saying don't pick it, just be respectful when you do. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing to remember with most things in life, really.
True. Anything else at this time of year? Because it is a bit of a lean season, isn't it?
It is. Lots of people say that with January. It's just about what you're looking at. So we can have a look out the window in the back garden at the moment and we've got chickweed everywhere. It's why I don't mow the grass.
Because you're collecting the chickweed.
We keep the weeds, yeah. So chickweed is a wonderful one at the moment. We've had the dehydrators going all week, drying it out. We then blend that into a powder, mix it in equal quantities with mould and salt, splash it with a tiny bit of water. It sounds counterproductive, but because you've got the crystalline salt in there, a little bit, just gently mix it together. Put it back in the dehydrator. Every couple of hours, just go in there and gently mix it again. You don't want to break down the salt crystals. You want to keep them nice and big. But this will get you a really nice flavoured salt and bright, vivid electric green.
That sounds amazing. Whoa, yeah.
Which is very nice. And the other things we've been picking out of the garden are still dandelions going around. You get the odd woodhaven root, which is basically like clove. It's the easiest way to describe it. It's hard to pick in the wild because obviously picking roots is illegal. So you have to ask landowners permission before you do it. But if you have them growing in your back garden, happy days.
What do they look like?
So every dog walker will recognise it, because other than burdock, when you have the seed heads that stick to you, woodhavens are the little ones. The other name for it is Herb Bennett.
I know it is Herb Bennett, yeah. Yes.
And you think of it as, so it was named after an old pope, and it's like the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, basically. It's a leaf at the end with three prong attack on it, and just before that leaf comes up, you've got two little leaves, one on either side, completely in line on the stem. It's a very easy one to identify. You go for the root, basically, when the leaves have pretty much died off. So this sort of time of year is brilliant. Some people say early spring, some people say Christmas, but I think anywhere in this time, you want the plant to be putting the energy back into the root again.
I've just been digging them up and not realising you can eat the roots.
Everyone does, and that's why it's a great thing to eat, because they're everywhere, they're not uncommon. Everyone digs them up. Next time you dig them up, run the roots under a tap and have a smell of them. There's no point in smelling them when they've got the mud on, because mud is far stronger in smell. So give them a wash. They'll get more intense. If you do have a dehydrator at home, dry them out, try them again then. They get more intense with that. If you don't, put your oven on pilot light, shut the door with something just in it a little bit, like a wooden spoon handle to let the air flow in, and leave it to dry out overnight, that kind of thing.
And then what would you do? Grind them up?
You can grind them up and use them as a spice. Yeah, you can do loads of things. We've played around with them in mulled wine before and things like that. But anything you'd use a clove for, really.
How interesting. Huh. I wonder if they would have been used before cloves were used.
I would imagine so, yeah, before the spice trade came in. Yeah.
And it's all these things we've forgotten about, or once upon a time people knew, people collected, and nobody really knows about them, unless, of course, they study them like you have.
Yeah, well, the difference is now we don't have to use them through necessity anymore. We have so much access to food on our doorsteps and all these air miles that go into all these lovely, wonderful foods that we fly from the other side of the world. We don't look on our doorsteps anymore. And it's much easier. I've got a new young family now, so I need to save some money so I can just go into the back garden. Instead of going out and buying loads of spinach or something, we just go out back and pick some chickweed for dinner.
Perfect. Oh, I love that idea. Right, I've got my eye on some chickweed at the moment. Brilliant. What do you think you'll be talking about in February then, Steve?
Well, what we'll be looking in February is a lot more of the plants that are shooting through at the moment, so we can go into what uses and what we're going to do with the main leaves of wild garlic to help you with what you do at home. We can go through some recipes on that. We'll be looking at things like cow parsley. Difference between cow parsley and hemlock. By next month we'll have the cow parsley through. It's starting to come through now. It'll be too early for the hemlock, but it's a good time to talk about the differences.
Perfect.
And it's a lovely wild plant that we don't really pick and use to eat, but it's also one that we group in a lot of other umbilifers into the category of, oh, it's cow parsley because it's white and flowering.
Mm. Not necessarily not. So.
No, so it's a good one to know the difference between.
Okay, fantastic. Well, look forward to speaking to you next month, Steve.
Excellent. Have a good one, Steve. Thank you
very much, Steve. Cheers.
Well, something to look forward to. Thanks to Steve Thompson, the foraging chef. And don't forget to look at Steve's Facebook page, The Foraging Chef, where you'll see some photos of the sorts of things he forages and, even more exciting, the meals he cooks using them.
Steve has now left the Green Man in Grantchester, which is sadly closed, but it was where his foraging enlivened the menu. He's now looking to set up on his own somewhere so that he can carry on doing the foraging chef food and gins and also put on live music. Do let him know if you know of anywhere that's available.
And here's news of free food available now, Saturday, in Cambridge. You can find this information on the Olio app. If you're listening to a repeat or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available. It's free to download.
Yes, and having a quick look at the app today, we find that Asma is giving away some open milk. Sounds a little bit unusual, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
But this is Aptamil milk. It's available just off Birdwood Road, so just contact Asma if you're interested. And I'd also like to give a rather more general shout-out this episode to the Olio community. Now, they are on the lookout for a food waste hero. This is somebody who can accept the food surplus that is donated by Pret a Manger. Now, the hero in question would help cover collection slots and distribute the food to the community via the Olio app. So what we're talking about here is plenty of sandwiches, salads, pastries, and you get to keep up to 10% of what you collect for yourself. So if this interests you, and it is a very good deed, email Olio, your user ID and your phone number to volunteer@olioex.com. And one more thing, don't miss out on the fact that there is an app called Too Good To Go, which is used by several food outlets in and around Cambridge to sell off any unsold goods shortly before they close, and at knockdown prices too.
Very good. Now, we've greatly enjoyed having Laura Donoghue on the programme with her marvellous essays. She began them in July with a simply wonderful piece about apricots and carried on with a marvel of good writing every month. And they're all still available to listen to online. Just search the Cambridge 105 radio website for past editions of Flavour. Today, though, it's the last, or at least the last in the current series. And today, Laura looks forward to what 2020 may bring and the importance of the National Food Strategy.
I love January. Despite its grey tendencies, I relish the fresh start, the hopeful certainty that last year's inadequacies can be redressed by what comes next, that this year's surprises will be of the pleasant variety. After the indulgences of the holidays, I'm craving energy-giving, mood-lifting food. And in keeping with the usual January spirit, I'm also resolved to get fitter and healthier. No more joking, I'll have two, one for each thigh. So what in the world to eat in this new year, this new decade? With what we learned in 2019 about climate change, biodiversity loss, plastics in our oceans, food waste, and the obesity crisis, the question, what should I eat, is more pressing and less purely personal than it's ever been. It's hard enough to know what's best to do for oneself, much less to carry through with acting on it. But how do we know what to do for our world as a whole and our patch of it? How do we trust to what's ethical and sustainable and recognize what's just pretending to be? There are so many heartbreaking emergencies, so many mixed messages, so much fervor that we could be in danger of making mistakes even with the best intentions, or simply sticking our heads in the sand, or diving into a bucket of donuts. There are certain home truths that can anchor us. Eating a diet rich in vegetables, fruit, and whole grains is very good for us. They get fiber and a rainbow of nutrients into us, help regulate our blood sugar, and are good for our gut health. They also keep us from eating too much of the wrong thing, like excess sugar and too much processed foods, which we know contribute to making us fatter and more ill. We know that less and better is also the watchword for meat, and more of us who eat meat are ever more discerning about where to source it. We know that tackling climate change, biodiversity loss, and many human diseases requires us to reform how we feed ourselves. To this end, the government is launching a comprehensive study to help develop the first national food strategy this nation has had since World War II. It commissioned food entrepreneur Henry Dimbleby, founder of the Leon Change, to look at the UK's food system in its entirety, consulting with every branch of government and in every region of the country, with farmers, scientists, manufacturers, the transport industry, wholesalers and retailers, health professionals, conservationists, educators, and the British public, to inform policies that will reform our current food system. The aim, it says, is to promote better health for us and our environment, and to ensure our food security. For as much as our current food system offers us in terms of unprecedented choice, convenience, and employment, 1 in 8 of us in the UK works in the sector, it's widely accepted that our food system does harm as well as good and is riddled with unintended consequences. The global food supply chain is responsible for 20 to 30% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. In the UK itself, production emissions are under 20%. But if what we consume from imported food is added to this, the total rises. With the increasing use of the world's land for agriculture, we've lost global habitats and wildlife at devastating rates. In the UK, songbirds decreased in numbers by 54% between 1966 and 2008. That's just 42 years. And almost all of our wildlife meadows have disappeared, and half our ancient woodlands. And too much of what our global food system produces is either wasted or making us fatter and more ill. In his address to the Oxford Farming Conference earlier this month, Henry Dimbleby reported that 18 of the world's largest food companies rely on food and drink portfolios in which 85% of products are regarded as so unhealthy they can't, under World Health Organization guidelines, be marketed to children. It is to be hoped that sound national food policies will result from this initiative, and it appears to be widely greeted as an opportunity for more solid evidence to come forth and more collaboration, and for the nuances and complexities of these challenges to be aired more thoughtfully and clearly by a range of voices who will help us understand the facts and choices we face. Some of these big picture questions will affect all our lives. What role do we want government to play in what we eat? How do we want to use our land? How do we get the most out of it while restoring and sustaining soil health, human health, ecosystems and wildlife? And what will our landscape look like in a decade, a century? What will our food taste like? With all these critical challenges, will taste get a look in? Will breeders select for varieties with flavor? Will farmers be empowered to grow such crops? Taste is so often superior in those fruits, vegetables, and meat that are given time, as well as all the right conditions, to grow and mature. And time, of course, needs to be reflected in the price of food. Is that a reality we are ready to accept? I'm glad that this initiative acknowledges the pleasure afforded by food, the social value of eating together, the heritage and culture implicit in our food. Whatever choices we need to make individually, as a nation, and globally, there are ways to factor in flavor and ways to factor it out. That's always a risk. It's happened often, it happens now, and we need to be alert to that as we debate how to reform the system. Good-tasting varieties of fruits and vegetables and breeds of meat, all grown well with respect for the land, the crops and animals, and those who will one day be eating them, are anything but frivolous considerations. Flavor isn't just an indulgence, the privilege of a few. A bias for flavor is built into our biology as part of our reward system. This can get us into trouble, but it can also help us get out of it. Plenty of research shows that we make food choices based more than anything on what tastes good to us, and that efforts to eat less and better work best when food brings us pleasure. We have many local resources here in Cambridgeshire afforded by those growers, retailers, cooperatives, and chefs who are doing a great service in producing and showcasing all manner of local produce grown sustainably and for superior flavor. I'll be visiting all my favorite local haunts this year for plums, apricots, cherries, soft fruit, apples, pears, celery, tomatoes, asparagus, and all manner of other vegetables, salad crops, and herbs grown right here. I'm delighted to see fresh produce getting more attention right now and being used so creatively as the centerpiece of a meal as well as the supporting act. And I'm excited at the signs that British farmers will respond to the growing interest in plant-based diets by growing more of the less common vegetables too, like salsify and artichokes. And if, like me, you are an omnivore aiming to eat less and better meat, you should know about the local producers who rear small, well-husbanded herds of special breed cattle on pasture in and around Cambridge. These passionate livestock farmers could not be more different from the intensive animal farming we've seen reported that relies on huge soy-dependent feedlots that displace rainforest. Angelica von Heimendahl's 60 red pole cattle are a familiar sight on Midsummer Common in the city and in the water meadows between Grantchester and the river. Angelica is one of few commoner farmers who still raise cattle on common land, as many commons around the country were lost in the 18th and 19th centuries with the Enclosure Acts. She's a member of the Pasture for Life movement that works to reduce the carbon footprint of cattle farming, and her red poles are fed exclusively on grass with no need for resource-intensive cereal feeds. They forage on the meadow for 9 months of the year, helping to keep the habitat from deteriorating into bramble. And in the winter, they're moved indoors and fed on hay, dried grass, and silage, fermented grass. She sells the meat throughout the year through her business, Cam Cattle, at the Cambridge Market on Sundays. Sam Taylor of Little Linton Farm also raises red poles, that beautiful mahogany brown breed native to this region. He sells his beef in mixed cuts by the box at the farm gate to a waiting list of customers who prize it for its deeper, beefier flavor and well-marbled texture. Sam explained that a lot of other breeds need grain to bring them to the required weight quickly, but cows are bred to eat grass, and a grain-rich diet gives their meat a different fat composition, lower in the essential fatty acids that are healthier for humans. His animals, like Angelica's, are fed purely on grass and given time to mature at their own pace, typically 24 to 30 months or longer, as opposed to 16 to 18 months for more conventionally reared cattle. Sam grazes his low-density herd in rotation on pasture land where they browse not only grasses, but the wild herbs, nettles, brambles, and legumes that also support pollinators and other wildlife. There's no need for fertilizers, and the pastures extend down to the water meadows along the River Granta, creating a corridor for nature. You can buy another special breed of beef from Robert Twigden's Longhorn Farm Shop in Cottenham, where he sells the meat from these handsome brown and white cattle raised by farmer Stephen White. Recognized by their distinctive downturned horns, this 17th century breed has become until recently scarce in the British countryside. But thanks to the Rare Breed Survival Trust and people like Stephen and Robert, it is once again being grown more widely for its superior flavor. You can buy it and the lamb also grown on Cuckoo Farm there at the shop. For people who want meat in their diet, supporting producers like these is a positive way to encourage responsible livestock farming while enjoying a special product. There is an environmental cost to everything we eat, plant or animal, land or sea. We have a good opportunity right now to learn, to distinguish between the very different production systems for all these food groups, from intensive monoculture to greenhouse grown to organic methods, and with livestock, from intensive mass production feedlots to small herds reared on permanent pasture or on mixed farms where they have an important role in improving soils, or on highlands and other terrain that can't support other kinds of agriculture where grazing animals have shaped the landscape for generations. So this new year, I'll be shopping with my reusable bags, buying a little less, seeking out honest food from friendly producers, and asking more questions. It takes effort, but procuring what we eat can be a chore or a pleasure, so whenever I can, I'll be making it as fun and social a way of spending time as I can. I'm also hoping, as Mr. Dimbleby says, for more light and less heat on the hard questions we all face, so we understand better the complex interrelationships we have with our food and food system, and can make informed decisions about how to influence it and our own health. I'm sure this new year will be a delicious one here in Cambridge, and maybe 2020 will also be the year of better focus when we see more clearly.
Yes, well, let's hope so. That was Laura Donoghue. The National Food Strategy does have a very wide brief and, well, the potential to do a lot of good.
I think it sounds really, really great. It's the first National Food Strategy for 70 years, and it's meant to be reporting this summer. So keep a lookout and get involved as necessary.
Yeah, and we at Flavour will keep an eye on it, won't we?
We will indeed.
And there's the music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Right, well, there's been quite a few this morning, and because I'm hungry, I've really focused on talking about food in the tweets. Bushel Box Farm Shop in Station Road, Willingham. Lots of local vegetables on sale, and the cafe is open this weekend as usual, selling Hot Numbers coffee, Kandula teas, and hot chocolate from Marimba Melts of Sudbury. And also, and this is the food bit, Wendy's marvellous homemade cakes, which I think are extremely good. There's marmalade cake, shortbread, chocolate and raspberry brownie, almond macaroons, Dorset-style apple tray bake.
Oh, don't.
The Geographer Deli in Station Road, Impington. Station Road, that's obviously the place to go for good food. Station Road in Cambridge has got Norfolk Bakery, hasn't it?
It has indeed. Smoke now, works. Yeah. Perfect.
Anyway, in the Station Road in Impington, there's vegan ciabatta paninis on sale today with vegan cheese and vegan pesto, finished with vine tomatoes and fresh basil. And in Ely today, there's a craft food and vintage market day. Darwin Nurseries in Cambridge is open with seed potatoes and onion sets on sale, and also Seville oranges for marmalade making. And at Calvary's Brewery in Hooper Street, Pizza Mondo are there from 12 till 3 and from 6 till 9.
Lovely. And don't forget that you can keep up with what we are tweeting by following us at Flavour 105. Now, the other week, I picked up a book from a charity shop called The Story of Craft Beer. It's by Pete Brown. It's short, it's funny, it's informative, and it made me want to go to a beer shop. So I headed down to Bacchanalia to chat about all things beery from those in the know.
13.49, please. Thank you. Do you need a bag at all? Great, cheers. So my name is... my name is Christian Hughes, but everyone calls me Jim. At Bacchanalia Wine Merchants on 90 Mill Road. Oh, yeah, and the Burnt Mills are drinking really well at the moment. If you want something a bit cleaner, the Rosetta Cone is great. That's fantastic. Well, that's classic. That's new, and a Nelson Stoven Bomb.
Oh, really?
This is delicious, that's delicious. Nelson so, yeah. So yeah. Shall I just stick with the Jim thing?
Yeah, Jim is good. So let's talk about Bacchanalia.
It's a little earthy, but I think that's always been part of the charm, and I know a lot of the customers like it. Handmade, hand-put-in wooden shelves by, I think it was actually Paul and his brother.
Paul being the man who set up Bacchanalia back in 1997. There are two branches. The first one was opened in Victoria Road, and the second one here on Mill Road.
It works really well because whilst they are slightly dangerous-looking shelves in a funny way, they hold a heck of a lot of wine. So when it's really stocked up and it's looking great, you walk in and you're just presented with a wall of wine. It's just all about the wine. And ditto when you go into the beer room, it's exactly the same. It has that smell, apparently. I've gotten used to it, but a lot of people walk in and say it smells somewhere between a church and a vineyard because it's probably many years of spilt wine and beer and wooden parquet floors. So there are people shopping here longer than I've worked here or longer than any member of staff has worked here. So, yeah. I started as a customer. I was at university down the road, got about 13 years ago. If you could find anything that wasn't either lager or ale in a pub, and at that point it was Hoegaarden or Leff, you were like, what is this? This is elixir. This is a beer that I've never even come across. And so that started me off on sort of looking for Belgian beers. I'd passed this place many, many times, didn't even know it was here, spotted the Belgian beers because my mind was turned on to that at the time, drank my way through most of it, and Ed, who was here at the time, said, did I want to work here? And as it turned out, I was already working at a local Threshers, so I was already au fait with working in an off-licence or a wine shop.
Did you imagine that, say, 10 years ago, a company like Threshers would no longer be around? And then we've had, say, like the rise of the independents, especially in Cambridge.
I always think of us as being very, very lucky. That is the case. Yeah. You know, I don't ever take it for granted. And I think that's why customer service is always going to be a massive part of that. But I also liken it to what's happening with restaurants at the moment. I think that people, they can be on a budget. When they're going to spend money, they want to feel that they're getting something a bit extra for the spend. Mm. And I think that's where independents play such a vital role, because you are getting to talk to people, and good independents can be sort of educating without being pompous, you know.
You have a question, he'll answer it.
It's hopped with Amarillo, so it's quite punchy on the bitterness, and you also have to open it and let it sit, because otherwise it's super effervescent at the beginning. Yeah. Open it near a sink, just in case, and then I'd say pour it out and let it, almost decant it, basically. You've learnt a little bit about what you've just spent your money on, rather than just arbitrarily spending money on it. I can't speak for the company, but I personally feel that I never take that for granted, and I it's always at the back of my mind that, you know, bad things can always happen to any business. Yeah. And so that kind of lights a fire under you, and it really tries to make you make it good for everybody. And when I go to other shops, other wine shops, and I get great service, that just inspires me to come back and try and do the same, because if I feel good walking out of a wine shop, I want other people to feel that too. So yeah. Well done.
I know.
But I don't have your zip and yeah.
Surely that's what it is. What have you got? You must have something I haven't got then.
Gout.
Yeah, I suspect that's probably the case.
I trained as an illustrator. That was maybe a little bit of a dream to be drawing, but in the end, it actually turned out that my palate was pretty good, and wine and food have been pretty much the core of my existence since then. So, yeah. Are you guys okay over there?
Yeah, sure.
Is this one of those places where people come in regularly asking for your advice?
Definitely, yeah. That's probably the most important thing that we do. Taste. I mean, like, that's one of the things we've always prided ourselves on. I mean, people come in and joke about, oh, you can't have tasted every wine in the shop. And you go, well, actually, between the beer and the wine, we've probably tasted about 80 to 90% of everything that's in here, if not more. And it sounds crazy, but I mean, that is, we spend a lot of time tasting wine. And I mean, you can't sell confidently a bottle of wine unless you know it inside out. And we track the vintages, and if the vintage goes off the boil, we drop the wine. Even if customers come back and say, oh, we really liked it, if the vintage is not up to scratch and we don't feel comfortable selling it at the price point it's at, we will just drop it. And then we'll, we might return to it the next year, you know, I mean, that's the way it goes, but yeah.
Excuse me, is this a cheese shop?
No, sir.
Well, that's getting knackered then, innit?
People say, how do you remember all of the terminology, or at least like the flavours and the aromas? But I always think, well, when you're walking down the street, you know, you pass a flower, you think, is that a rose? Is it a geranium? Is it whatever? If you smell oil on the pavement, that's oil. You know, I just don't think of it as memorising something for a specific field. It just is a place to share all of those senses, really. So it's really difficult, because sometimes people come in and they ask for something. Yeah. Like I had a customer come in and ask for a pairing for a risotto once, and I was talking through all the classics for that, and then asked what kind of risotto it was at the end, and then was told it was strawberry. And that, you kind of think, well, that's an important thing to tell somebody up front, you know, that it's a strawberry risotto you're pairing for. But, you know, these things happen, so, yeah.
Does it go with strawberry risotto, by the way?
Actually, no. It's maybe mascarpone, and it's kind of somewhere between a main and a dessert. It's slightly cheesy and slightly strawberry-ish.
It's a vile concept.
The weirdest thing was they really, really wanted me to pair a full-bodied red with it. I said, no. No. I said, you want is like a Moscato, something with a semi-sparkling off-dry number. But they walked out with a Pinot Noir from Burgundy in the end, because they just wanted red. They'd obviously read somewhere that red was the way forward.
I'm hoping the payoff would be through them out of the shop.
Never, ever coming here again.
I don't think they will be coming back, because they will have got home and tasted that red. And this is a perfect example of when you can do your best to try and pair something for someone. Yeah. But if they want a specific thing that's not right, they'll get home and the person who gets blamed is the wine merchant.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. Like, oh, this doesn't work at all. And he's like, I could have told you that, but you didn't want to listen at the time. But yeah.
Yeah, well, there's no way of getting... Yeah.
There was one thing you mentioned to me the other day, sours. It's kind of bringing wines and beers together.
Synergizing, in a way. You've got the explosion in natural wines and the explosion in sour beers, which I think happened independent of one another, because sour beers, lambic beers at least, come from a tradition of spontaneous fermentation in open vats, where ambient yeast drops out the atmosphere into open vats and spontaneously ferments. And also with Fuda sours, you're having the reaction between bacteria that's trapped in the wood with yeasts in the beer, and that's what creates Fuda sours. Mm. And then you've got, also happening in the natural wine world, a very, very similar process occurring with people using minimal intervention, at least with winemaking, using indigenous yeasts, natural sugars, essentially allowing the climate to inform the winemaker what to do. And they've just married up beautifully. And natural wine doesn't have to be super funky. Some is. Some you could drink and you would hardly even know it was a natural wine. Yeah. You've got beer drinkers who are used to quite challenging styles of sour beers, and some of the funkier end of the spectrum of wines that may have volatile acidity, where it's almost nail varnishy or vinegary or acetic on the nose, is not dissimilar to what they're experiencing in Fuda sours or in lambic beers. So it works really well in that respect. You can almost spot a natural wine a mile off, apart from the fact that sometimes they're in clear glass and cloudy, or, you know, almost exotic colours. The actual branding and the labelling tends to either look incredibly homemade, and there's almost a rule of thumb, the worse the label looks, the better the wine could possibly be. But there are, of course, all kinds of premium producers out there, but tend to opt for textural papers, interesting materials, hand-drawn labels, or, you know, things that really cry out natural, yeah.
And it's such an expression of the people behind the product, if you like.
I love the labels, I love some of the words.
You look at some of these quirky little labels here, it looks like someone's daughter has designed them. Or son.
Everything we do is done by hand, handcrafted, hand bottled, hand waxed, hand labelled.
And we all know that one glance at the label can make a huge amount of difference, because it puts ideas straight into your head.
My God, you can't sell a wine with that label. I mean, it's a lovely wine, but that label is shocking. And so we realise that a lot of people pick their wines off the shelf because of the label that they see on, you know, in front of them.
So many people's purchases can sometimes come down to the label. beer cans have just become an artwork source. Almost like,
well, you take Northern Monk, they worked with local artists who they wanted to champion, to the point where you had cans with peel off labels inside, had the information about galleries, information on the artist, the medium that they use, taking art onto cans. The irony is that ages ago you used to have old school beer customers who would peel off the labels and keep them and stick them in their kitchens or whatever, yeah. And people used to think that was also fuddy-duddy, and now we've come full circle where there are now producers who are giving you labels that you can peel off yourself, but with useful information on about the artist that they've collabed with. So yeah.
I noticed through one of your tweets there has also been, and this has been running for a couple of years, the Beer and Art series at the Tate.
All right.
An end-of-year beer and art takeover, featuring illustrations that adorn UK craft beer producers that you'll find at Bacchanalia, such as Pressure Drop and Burnt Mill. You can check out the art online at beerandart.co.uk.
My particular favourite is from Amundsen Brewery. Have I said that right?
Amundsen
Brewery. Yeah. They're from Oslo, Norway.
That's right, yeah.
Their stuff is incredible.
Pineal Grand, that's called, as in the pineal gland. So it's all to do with DMT, psychedelia.
When I was looking at their stuff, it was reminding me of Grateful Dead, Yes, Tangerine Dreams, early Santana stuff as well.
Yep, I can see the Yes and the sort of proggy element to it as well. And a bit of metal too, because I think there's such a connection between Scandinavia and sort of extreme metal as well.
There was a song by Nirvana back in 93 called The Radio Friendly Unit Shifter. What are your kind of your wintertime unit shifters? Do you have like an increase in the purchase of whiskey or anything like that?
Oh, definitely. I think the interesting thing is that gin has become such a focus on spirit purchasing. Yeah. That sells all year round. And of course you have mulled gin in the winter and strawberry gin in the summer and all sorts. So as much as I love gin, it has taken the emphasis, I find, off of other spirits a little bit. Thankfully, this year, I was really happy to see that gin was selling, but whiskey really, really came back for us this year. Interestingly, I noticed people were moving slightly away from peaty whiskies, which have been incredibly popular, and wanted more sherry monsters and Speyside styles and Highland styles, single malts, yeah.
You'd noticed a bit of a surge in people buying port.
Yeah, all year round.
I'm going, why was that? What was the reason, you know?
I was no one's actually answered that question, and it was really unusual, because I gently say when customers come in looking for port in summertime, you know, I kind of have a little joke with them and say, port in the summertime, but I did that the first couple of times, and then after a while, people just kept coming in asking for port, and I thought, I'm not talking about dry white port here with tonic and as a long drink, I'm talking about people wanting big ruby ports in the middle of summer. So I don't know whether or not it was people visiting Cambridge, and because obviously it's seen as a very English product or whatever. And so maybe it was an element of tourism and port purchases due to that. It could have been. I had to tweet about it because it just seemed so unusual. I mean, I've never had a summer where people wanted port so frequently. Yeah.
Maybe it'll happen again this year.
I'm prepared just in case.
Now, recently, they'd also introduced a line of Greek wines.
And that was something that Sam Owens over at Thirsty did, I think a year or so earlier, where he felt like now was the right time to start introducing Greek wines and getting people off of the mindset of Retsina and the low quality of Greek wines. And I did a little bit with Alice Archer at the Cambridge Wine Merchants at the time as well. Did it have any impact? Did you recognise much?
It was amazing.
Was it?
Yeah. You know, some suppliers, you just buy from them. Other suppliers, you literally get friendly with your rep, and they know what you're going to like, and you are literally working together rather than just somebody doorstepping you and trying to make you buy wines you don't necessarily care about. Well, one had brought some really funky Greek wines that were all natural. They were just off the wall. Not for everyone, but definitely needed to be out there. And then the other one was a producer called Lyrakis. One, the producer came to the shop and did a tasting with the supplier, which is always nice. Tasted through the wines, and there was not a single wine there that wasn't brilliant. And then even better, the price points were where you wanted them to be or even under. You know, when you've got value and amazing wine and a friendly producer, you just think, like, this has to happen. Pop them on the shelf. People coming through the door, they were asking for a Viognier here or something to go with a fish recipe there, and you just go, well, that's an Assyrtiko, try this, because this Vidiano is a bit like a Viognier here. And suddenly people were picking up wines at sort of 11, 12, 13 pounds and realising that they were brilliant. And I thought I'd bought too much Greek wine, and we sold out in about 2 weeks. Oh. And I had people coming back saying, when are you going to get more Greek wine back in? And unfortunately, it comes from a supplier we can't order from all the time, because they do a lot of our fine wines as well, so they tend to shift slower than the cheaper end of the spectrum. And so I got some more in, thankfully, at Christmas time. I'm planning on getting some more in the coming months as well. But yeah, the response was brilliant. So yeah.
And if you're the adventurous type, Bacchanalia has you covered with some interesting new flavours, such as North Brewing Co.'s 8% Stout with porcini and cacao.
I have a regular customer here called Gabriele. He's Italian, and he brought me a porcini imperial stout, and I just thought that was the most bonkers idea. And this was, I mean, super porcini, and it worked amazingly. And everybody, I sent pictures to friends saying, check this out, this is amazing. So when this came through, I just had to have it in the shop because I knew how well that pairing worked, as weird as it sounds. Porcini's just got such a lovely umami, earthy, distinct quality to it, and then balanced with the bittersweetness of the chocolate, and it's kind of like a bittersweet umami with the porcini as well. So yeah, I thought that was an absolutely brilliant idea, and more of it. I love porcini, I love more mushrooms, and I love beer. So yeah. Thanks.
Nice to meet you, Jim.
You too.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And that was Jim of Mill Road Branch of Bacchanalia, and you can find out more at their website, which is winegod.co.uk. What a great website name, winegod, all one word. You can follow them on Twitter too, at bacchanalia_cam. And their other branch, their original branch, is certainly alive and well, and that is at 79 Victoria Road.
This is a time of year that many of us decide to take up new pursuits. One which my partner took up a while ago is keeping honeybees. And as you probably know, bees and other insects are under threat. That matters enormously, not only because bees provide honey, but even more, they and other insects pollinate flowers. And that's what provides the seeds for future generation of plants, and of course it's also needed for food production. I spoke with bee expert Peter Kaslevitz about the threat to bees, also about beekeeping, and about his website, and it offers much support to beekeepers, and if you happen to get a nasty swarm.
We're losing bees, and not just bees, we're losing all of the insects around. We're losing beetles, we're losing butterflies, we're losing many, many insects, and it causes, actually, we can call it windscreen phenomenon, which is simply to see what's happening when you drive in the summer on the countryside in the nighttime, and you don't see any dead insects on your car or on your windscreens or lights anymore. What was actually completely different before. It means how we change our planet, how we're changing our ecosystem, how much we're losing insects, not just bees, but all insects around. My background is commercial beekeeping, and we used to use chemicals in apiaries around the globe. Chemicals, of course, which not kill bees, but kill the bee pathogens. Bees, like all animals, they have their own illnesses. They have disease, like we human, we of course get ill sometimes. And we go to the drugstore and we buy medicine. But we start discover, actually, we don't really need sometimes this medicine, and the antibiotics now is the movement to maybe stop it or reduce, right? It's not good for our health on the end of the day. So we, as a beekeepers, we start to rethink our practices, and I decided don't do that, don't treat bees, because bees got huge ability, own mechanisms which can help them to fight back disease, to be healthy, and just we need to help them. The way we helping them is to create for them environment, beehive, and environment which is the best for them to do it. It means no chemicals, no stress, no chemicals. We've got so many chemicals around. We've got pesticides, we've got fungicides, we've got herbicides, and all these chemicals harming our insects, I'm afraid. So I try to locate it, place my apiaries, my beehives, in very carefully chosen locations without chemicals access, and close to nature reserved or organic farms, or even in a urban areas. And ironically, urban areas, they bring a lot of food for bees without chemicals, because there is no agriculture in, let's say, city of Cambridge, and we've got a lots of gardens, and it's big biodiversity, which gives our bees good food without chemicals. Unfortunately, farms, agriculture, huge monocultures with one crop, which is not very good, it's not diversity of diet, and this food is contaminated by fungicides, by pesticides and herbicides. And this food actually eat bees, and then they get weaker. When they get weaker by these chemicals, then they start be ill of their own disease. Without this chemical, they still can fight back. They still can manage own disease. But because of the pollution and basically the chemicals in their food, they get ill and they die.
As it's winter time, we don't see the bees much. I mean, are they all asleep? What is happening in the hive now?
Honeybees don't hibernate. They sleep like we sleep. We sleep in nighttime usually. And bees, you sleep in nighttime, but usually during a day they change. Some bees sleep, some bees work. They help each others. But during a winter, Apis mellifera, honeybees, they cluster and they keep warm. Because why they call honeybees? They call honeybees because they produce a lot of honey. Why they produce a lot of honey? They produce a lot of honey for winter to generate energy from that sugar, and this energy helps them to keep warm and survive winter time.
So bees really can look after themselves, or do we have to feed bees in the winter?
If we don't take honey from bees, and they have enough food from the flowers during summer, spring as well, and the autumn, they can survive without our help.
When did your fascination with bees start?
I think everything began when I was a kid. When I was a child, I was watching my father in an apiary, and I helped him a lot. And then I've seen this small insect flying so beautifully and buzzing around, bring nectar and pollen and create our life. And then I was fascinated by how they work, how they communicate, how they go to the hive, how they build combs, and how they create a super organism and a beautiful house, the beehive and the wax combs. And then I think it was then, and many, many years was like a gap, break. I done different things. I've been salesman and I work for different companies. And then I came back. I am now with bees again after 20 years maybe. So was a beginning. Actually, my grandma started keep bees, and my father, like me, when he was younger, he seen beehives, and then everything began. So this is the passion. We actually keep bees because we love them, and they love us. They bring something for us, and we give them home, we give them help, and then they give us honey and the support of our plants and our ecosystem.
And you also have a website, I believe.
Yes, we now launched a new website which shows our work, what we do, and calls cambridgehoneybees.co.uk, Cambridge Honeybees. And we try to promote also through that website natural beekeeping and reduce chemicals message to the people.
Well, that was Peter Kastlievitz, and his website is well worth looking at. Very informative.
And there is Green Onion signalling the start of our news section, and we begin with jobs.
Yeah, Michael House Cafe in Trinity Street is looking for a cafe assistant. You'll be trained with all the skills needed to be part of the kitchen team and the front of house team. Details are on the website indeed.co.uk, from which you can also apply.
The Brewers Inn in Milton is opening a new gastropub-style restaurant with four bed and breakfast rooms. And so they're looking for a chef de partie, a commis chef, and kitchen porters. If any of these positions suit you, you can find full details on Gumtree in the jobs section under hospitality and catering.
And Shelford Deli, voted amongst the UK's top 50 independent cafes and bistros, is looking for a full-time chef. Now, this is a position partly covering their pastry section for maternity leave purposes and partly in the main kitchen, working both service and the artisan pizza section. So if that takes your interest, you can apply by calling Cambridge 846129.
Jack of Jack's Gelato fame is looking for someone to take on the marvellous full-time role at his production facility in Coldham's Lane. You'll be churning ice cream and doing tasting as well. Good pay, 20 to 24,000 a year, depending on experience. It's on Gumtree in the hospitality and catering section.
And there's a new independent, stylish chocolatier in All Saints Passage called Hill Street. It's specialised in dark chocolate. It's open from Tuesdays to Saturdays, 10 until 4.
And that is all the time that we have for today. Flavour is repeated tomorrow at 2 p.m. and we'll have a podcast the following week.
Right, and what's coming up next on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio? It's Women Making Waves, and at 3 o'clock, the Gadget Guide. But we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.